Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up...
Did the president, the reports that are out there, ask you in any way, shape, or form to back off or downplay the Russian investigation?
I'm not going to discuss the specifics of conversations with the president of the United States, but I stand by the comment I just made to you, sir.
Top intelligence officials deflect questions about President Trump and alleged interference in the Russia investigation. Also today, Quebec, Jerusalem, Nice, Berlin, London. Can we stop terrorists from turning vehicles into weapons? And in sports, Red Sox broadcaster Jerry Remy feels the heat after saying language translators should not be allowed on the pitcher's mound.
Learn baseball language. You know, it's pretty simple. I mean, you break it down pretty easy between pitching coach and pitcher after a long period of time.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We will not discuss private conversations in a public hearing. That was what today's testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee boiled down to when the nation's top intelligence officials were asked repeatedly if President Donald Trump had asked them to push back against the FBI's investigation of the Trump campaign. Here's how Senator Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia, put the day's most pressing question.
In your experience, would it be in any way typical for a president to ask questions or bring up an ongoing FBI investigation, particularly if that investigation concerns associates and individuals that might be associated with the president's campaign or his activities?
Admiral Michael Rogers, director of the National Security Agency, responded.
In the 3+ years that I have been the director of the National Security Agency, to the best of my recollection, I have never been directed to do anything I believe to be illegal, immoral, unethical, or inappropriate. And to the best of my recollection, during that same period of service, I do not recall ever feeling pressured to do so.
But Senator Warner doubled down.
Did the president, the reports that are out there, ask you in any way, shape, or form to back off or downplay the Russia investigation?
I'm not going to discuss the specifics of conversations with the President of the United States, but I stand by the comment I just made to you, sir.
Rogers was referring to yesterday's Washington Post story that says President Trump asked Daniel Coats, the director of national intelligence, to get former FBI director James Comey to back off from his investigation into the Trump campaign. The Post reported, quote, "The interaction with Coats indicates that Trump aimed to enlist top officials to have Comey curtail the bureau's probe." But today, before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Coats refused to give details about his conversations with the president.
I do not feel it's appropriate for me to, in a public session in which confidential conversations between the president and myself, I don't believe it's appropriate for me to address that in a public session.
Well, Senator Angus King, independent from Maine, was not satisfied. He sharply questioned each member of the panel in turn. Here's his exchange with NSA Director Rogers.
Why are you not answering these questions? Is there an invocation by the President of the United States of executive privilege? Is there or not?
Not that I'm aware of.
Then why are you not answering
our
questions?
Because I feel it is inappropriate, Senator.
What you feel isn't relevant, Admiral.
King also questioned acting FBI Director Andrew McCabe about why he wouldn't reveal details of his conversations with his predecessor, James Comey. Here's McCabe.
It would not be appropriate for me, sir, to discuss issues that are potentially within the purview of the special counsel's investigation.
And that's the basis of your refusal to answer this question?
Yes, sir. And that and knowing, of course, that Director Comey will be sitting
behind
this table.
So it's your
tomorrow.
Position that the special counsel is entitled to ask you questions about this, but not an oversight committee of the United States Congress?
Well, as he closed today's hearing, Senator Richard Burr, Republican of North Carolina, asked each intelligence official to take a message back to the administration that they cannot hide things from the Senate Intelligence Committee and are required to be fully forthcoming. Burr then continued.
At no time should you be in a position where you come to Congress without an answer. It may be in a different format, but the requirements of our oversight duties and your agencies demand it.
Senator Warner then ended with this.
Again, I want to thank all the witnesses, but I come out of this hearing with more questions than when I went in.
Well, some of those questions may be answered tomorrow when former FBI Director James Comey is scheduled to testify before the same committee. His official statement was actually posted today, so there is so much to dig into. Let's do that with Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. He's been watching the hearing today, and he joins us now from D.C. Matt, it's good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I feel like we just took a roller coaster ride all day long from questions to not answering questions. I mean, what was this hearing like?
The hearing, your recap did it well, where there was a lot of back and forth. The reason for the hearing was to talk about FISA court orders, you know, something totally unrelated. But you had the top intelligence officials before the Senate Intelligence Committee, and they continued to press them on answers about their discussions with the president over the Russia investigation. And they pretty much stonewalled, you know, without citing executive privilege, which is a more formal process, and they didn't cite that, but they cited not wanting to discuss their private conversations with the president, and it got quite testy, particularly the Angus King exchange was fairly heated between them. Marco Rubio, some of the Republicans were also pressing them quite a bit, and John McCain as well. He's not on that committee, but he showed up anyways to ask some questions.
Yeah. So what do you? I mean, you mentioned that testy exchange between King and McCabe. I mean, what do you make of the fact that the acting FBI director basically said that he couldn't or wouldn't comment on his conversations with James Comey because of the fact that Robert Mueller is special counsel here, and he didn't want to interfere with that investigation?
Yeah, I mean, that got more into sort of who has the oversight, you know, and there was a very sort of testy moment, again, with Angus King, sort of saying that Congress has oversight even more so than Mueller. So they kept sort of deferring to Mueller, saying that they treat investigations as things where you don't want to comment publicly on things, which triggered Mark Warner to say, well, does the President of the United States know that? Because, of course, President Trump in his Twitter feed has been commenting, you know, quite regularly about ongoing investigations here. So there was a lot of these moments of them trying to get these guys to say something, and they were sort of determined not to.
Do you think that there's likely to be any impact from the fact that these top intelligence officials wouldn't answer questions publicly before the Senate Intelligence Committee today? Is it likely to have an impact on the ongoing congressional investigations?
They may have to call them back. There was an appetite to do that, including potentially in closed session, to address some of the concerns of those testifying who don't want to talk publicly. But the senators feel a responsibility as a result of their oversight role to hear from them. So there was a possibility of having a closed door hearing, even though some of the discussions are not classified. So there's not necessarily a legal reason for them to be done behind closed doors, but that seemed to be one potential avenue for the senators to get information from the intelligence community without having it done in a public setting.
All right, Matt. So let's talk about the big show, if I can put it that way, that's expected for tomorrow, because former FBI Director James Comey is going to sit at that very table and testify publicly and then also privately before the Senate Intelligence Committee. His prepared remarks were actually released today by the Senate Intelligence Committee, and I'm seeing here they're quite lengthy. And there's a paragraph in which Comey is expected to say that the president did ask Comey, quote, "I need loyalty. I expect loyalty." And Comey then is going to say that, quote, "I didn't move, speak, or change my facial expression in any way during the awkward silence that followed. We simply looked at each other in silence. The conversation then moved on." I mean, have you had a chance to take a look at the prepared remarks that Comey's expected to give?
Yeah, they're 7 pages long, and, you know, critics of Comey's, including the president, call him a showboat, and, you know, his testimony sure does put on a show. I mean, there are is vivid detail about his meetings with the president privately on several occasions. Comey made a point early in his testimony to say that he, after his first meeting with President Trump at Trump Tower, he went outside in his FBI vehicle and immediately typed out a memo on his laptop, which was something that he hadn't done in the past, he says. He met twice with President Obama privately, in once in person, both of those in person. He met 9 occasions with President Trump over 4 months, growing so concerned at one point that he asked Attorney General Jeff Sessions to prevent the two of them from being in the room alone together. So Comey does, I mean, he confirms a lot of what has been in the news media,
right,
you know, over the past couple of weeks, about Trump asking him for loyalty, about Trump asking him to drop any investigation into his former NSA National Security Advisor Mike Flynn. There are instances like that, but in just greater detail than we had had previously.
Well, in fact, the detail, I mean, clearly James Comey has been an investigator, because the kind of detail he puts in this statement is, you know, he talks about remembering which doors were open and closed in the Oval, and remembering, you know, the door by the grandfather clock is the one he exited the Oval Office after one of these meetings with the president. And yeah, and as you said, I mean, he confirms what's been reported in the press, that he says the president told him, quote, "I hope you can see your way to clear to letting this go, to letting Flynn go. I hope you can let this go." I mean, so what can we anticipate hearing more from Comey after his prepared remarks yesterday? What kind of questions are the senators going to ask him?
I think it'll be interesting, you know, how hard Republicans will be on Comey. If there are Republicans who try and discredit some of his testimony, if they consider themselves allies of the president, I imagine they'll ask him, you know, questions about why he didn't put some of this information out sooner, or if he was so concerned about his private meetings with Trump, why he had 9 encounters with him one-on-one. You know, I imagine that there will be some tough questioning. There will, you know, from Democrats, I think, trying to elicit even more information. I mean, we have a lot in this 7-page of, which is sort of Comey's introductory testimony. You know, so I'm sure that we'll get more, and there will be more back and forth and room for questioning tomorrow. But it certainly is kind of it's explosive in the sense that President Trump has so often criticized leaks and anonymous sources. Now you have an actual person who is testifying under oath tomorrow to these encounters with President Trump.
Right.
And I think that sort of changes the dialogue a little bit from anonymous sources and attacks on the news media to James Comey himself appearing in the halls of Congress.
Matt Visor, he's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's time now for the Remembrance Project. Writer Alyssa Eli's look at the extraordinary lives of ordinary folks from our community. Today, Eli recalls a Boston journalist remembered as a mentor.
With a pair of glasses low on her nose and a continual cup of coffee, Helen Woodman Harrington ran the State House News Service from her desk in room 458. For newly minted journalists, it was a heady, hard-working chance to cover government in real time, running in and out of hearing rooms, scribbling in reporter notebooks, asking one more question they knew Helen would want to know about this week's Governor's Council meeting or that Community Reinvestment Act. Lisa Capone arrived fresh out of UMass Amherst in 1980 and worked at the news service for 6 years. She'd heard the editor liked Manhattans and smoked vigorously. She expected a grizzled presence.
Instead, there's this woman in a classic tweed skirt and sweater and, you know, low sensible heels and a very calm voice who sort of ushered us through this initiation of what journalism really was.
There was nothing Helen didn't know about the Massachusetts governing process. She spoke State House fluently. News outlets, lobbyists, and trade organizations relied on her reporters, the kids, who would type their articles on carbon paper and stuff them into cubbyhole mailboxes for clients to use in their own publications. The kids were always on a deadline. Any given day might hold 8 committee hearings to cover, and the House and Senate in session, and the governor's schedule. But Helen made clear that speed and accuracy could coexist.
So they would gavel in at 11 o'clock in the morning, you know, and typically do a few routine things, and then they'd recess and come in at 1 o'clock for their formal session, which could go until 5 or 6 o'clock, or it could go until 3 o'clock in the morning or until the next day. And we covered every second of it.
Helen did, too.
If it was really late, she always stayed. She lived in an apartment that overlooked Boston Common on Tremont Street. And I remember she used to walk across that. We used to hate it because she would just, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and she'd walk home like it was nothing.
In the male worlds of politics and journalism, edges could be rough. But Helen was consistently, infectiously genteel.
It was just somehow through osmosis we were sort of getting this transfusion of how to do our jobs and also how to treat people, how to live your life. I mean, these aren't lessons that are just good for journalism. These are lessons that are good for life. You know, be honest, be fair, listen, don't assume.
For 28 years, Helen would and did do anything for her kids and her wire service. She believed fervently that political journalism was the fourth branch of government, essential to the functioning of a citizen nation, and she thrived in the crucible of Massachusetts politics. At the same time, through all those years, which was a miracle in that environment, though not if you knew her, she kept her political opinions to herself.
Writer Alyssa Eli, remembering Helen Harrington. To suggest someone for remembrance, email remember@wbur.org. We'll be back. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In a 2010 edition of its online magazine, Inspire, Al-Qaeda gave its followers a new set of instructions. They wrote, quote, "Use a pickup truck as a mowing machine, not to mow grass, but to mow down the enemies of Allah." Now, the instructions were accompanied by a picture of the iconic Ford Super Duty pickup truck. Al-Qaeda followers have acted in Jerusalem, Nice, Quebec, Berlin, Columbus, and most recently in London. Cars and trucks, something so ubiquitous and common, they can be so easily turned into a weapon of terror. But can they be stopped? Is there a way to prevent these low-tech terror attacks? Well, that's the question our next guests ask in their recent Atlantic article. It's titled London and the Mainstreaming of Vehicular Terrorism. Colin Clark is a researcher and political scientist at the RAND Corporation, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Louis Clarivas. He teaches global affairs at UMass Boston. Louis Clarivas, welcome back to you.
Thank you for having me.
So gentlemen, I wonder if you could just start by explaining to us your view as to why it seems we're seeing more and more of these kinds of attacks where vehicles are used as a weapon. I mean, what's been changing regarding Al-Qaeda and ISIS that's making these attacks more frequent?
Well, let's be clear. These are mostly ISIS-perpetrated attacks, mm-hmm. At least recently, even though Al-Qaeda, as you mentioned, did persuade its followers back in 2010 or urge its followers to engage in such style attacks. Look, they're opportunistic and they're simple. And I think one of the things, at least in my mind, that differentiates ISIS from Al-Qaeda is that ISIS is much more willing to settle for attacks that result in lower lethality numbers. Al-Qaeda in some ways set the bar very high with 9/11 and did not want to engage in what it saw as kind of these lower level attacks because it was worried that it would be seen as impotent following the spectacular attack of 9/11.
Just quickly follow up on that? You could think of it almost in terms of a distinction between quality and quantity, where Al-Qaeda really had its eye set on spectacular symbolic attacks. ISIS is a little bit, as Colin says, lowers the bar a little bit, interested more in kind of, you know, one attack after another, as many as possible. So they're willing to kind of accept the hybrid model. Not that they don't have symbolic attacks. And we saw today that they've claimed responsibility for an attack on the parliament in Iran, as well as on the late Ayatollah Khomeini's gravesite. Mm-hmm. But they also welcome low-tech attacks, such as what we saw in Manchester or in Paris.
Right. I mean, and in fact, you write that the Islamic State, in their published guide for would-be attackers or murderers, they note that, you know, the advantage they see in vehicles is that they're really easy to acquire. I mean, they're ubiquitous, and they don't – we're surrounded by cars and trucks, so they don't necessarily – raise suspicion amongst, you know, innocent people just walking across a bridge or down the street. So what kind of specific security challenges does this mode of terrorism present to officials, to law enforcement, to us as individuals, Colin Clark?
Look, it's really difficult to stop. And going back to what Lou said before with the quality versus quantity debate, I think for ISIS, quantity has a quality all of its own, and so they're happy to just continue this high operational tempo. We've seen it during last year during Ramadan. We're seeing it again. It seems as though there's attack nearly every day. And if you think back to a couple of weeks ago, there was the incident in Times Square where there was a vehicle that I think resulted in the killed one person. But as soon as it happened, everyone thought right away, oh, wow, probably a terrorist attack, probably ISIS. So it just shows the psychological impact that this group has had by using vehicles. They seem to be almost everywhere at once, even when they're not behind an incident itself. It's on everybody's mind. And so, you know, a large part of terrorism is striking that psychological fear, and they've clearly achieved that.
Mm. Professor Kleeris, let me just turn the same question to you and get your view on this. I mean, one of the particular challenges, I'd say, with trying to find ways to prevent, or at least, well, prevention is one thing, but to secure people from this kind of attack is that because cars are and trucks are so interwoven into everyone's daily life, how can you come up with a solution that doesn't interfere with daily life and doesn't, you know, clamp down people's civil liberties? We could stop people from renting cars and trucks, but I mean, no one wants to live in a world like that.
Yeah. So the simple answer is there's nothing you can do to stop these attacks from occurring. We can't zero them out. Let me put it that way. They can't be zeroed out. What we can do is try to minimize the damage that vehicular terrorism can wreak on a particular community. One of the things to keep in mind here is that there are measures that we can take that will defend against vehicular terrorism to some extent. And we actually saw this in Times Square. If you've seen the video clips that were online following that person's rampage, he was able to drive up three blocks basically without any obstacles from 42nd through 45th. And then when the moment he got to 45th Street, he hit what looked like either concrete or metal stanchions or, mm-hmm. or bollards and flipped his car up. There are ways to find areas that would be high density, in other words, places where people are tightly packed in, and you can secure the pedestrian walk areas around there with stanchions, with jersey barriers. Will it inhibit, you know, people moving? Not much. It could create traffic problems. But the part that you can't secure against is, you know, people do have to cross from one corner to the other.
Right.
And you can't have jersey barriers in the middle of an intersection. And so people will still get hit. The question is, you know, are you only hitting people that are in that intersection, or are you able to drive across an entire bridge or up three entire city blocks and hit everybody there? So it's not a question of stopping this. It's a question of minimizing the damage.
Hmm. I mean, you and Colin present this sort of four-pronged approach of considering what would make for, I mean, this is such a sobering conversation, but what would make for potential targets for vehicular terrorism, right? You mentioned some of them, density, confinement, access, and mass, right?
Correct. We call it the DCAM model. Academics have a fondness for acronyms, but it really, to make it, you know, to put it in lay language, density just refers to how tightly packed an area is. Confinement, you know, how trapped are those people in that densely packed area? Access is how approachable is that population to, you know, for a vehicle? And then finally, mass. How big is the vehicle? So those four factors are critical to whether or not an attack is successful and whether or not an attack kills a lot of people. So you could see in the attack on Bastille Day in Nice, 86 people died because those people were tightly packed into a confined space. They couldn't really get out of the way. And it was a huge lorry that kind of basically got in and was able to run people over for quite a long distance, I might add.
Mm. Colin Clark, could it be possible in the future that there may be some technological ways to stop the vehicles themselves? I mean, we've been talking about sort of targets that might make for attractive targets, but you know, as cars and trucks become more technological, is it feasible that like there could be a software fix for? I mean, I don't want to say fix, but intervention.
No, I mean, you know, I'm not a technologist, but I think that's certainly something that folks are looking at or are certainly thinking about, particularly as, you know, driverless cars are on the road more and more. So I think that it's probably on the docket, you know, looking at technical ways to shut off the ignition of all vehicles within a certain radius or on a specific vector, as they all rely on computers, right? And so, mm-hmm. so that's something to potentially think about. You know, I just want to address kind of some of the underlying the factors here. I mean, think about the discussion we're having right now and think about some of the things that Theresa May has said in the last few days. We're talking about fundamentally altering a lot of very basic components of our society. Mm. And so, in a sense, you know, terrorists have claimed victory right then and there, cutting off the internet, thinking about ways that, you know, we can prevent people from driving. These are really simple, everyday things that, you know, terrorism has, you know, really changed the way that we go about our daily lives.
Well, with that thought, I mean, Professor Louis Clarivas, Colin Clark was there mentioning, you know, Theresa May has talked about perhaps censoring parts of the internet and, again, working with, as she said, allied democratic governments to regulate cyberspace. Maybe I just have to accept the fact that, yes, things have changed that dramatically. But, is there a way to look at this situation from an optimist point of view, Professor Clarivas, that, you know, in truth, that I have to remind myself and others that the actual risk of any individual being the victim of a terrorist act still remains very low.
Oh, yeah. One of my other areas of expertise is mass shootings. And, you know, I can tell you that more people die every day in the United States as a result of gun violence than as a result of terrorist violence. In fact, terrorist violence is is just a small dot within a bigger kind of concentric circle of gun violence. And then, you know, if we look at other factors, that's even a wider concentric circle. So, terrorism does not kill, in relative terms, that many people, but it does frighten a lot of people. And as Colin points out, it does cause us to adjust our way of life. So is there an optimistic perspective? There is, if you look at it in terms of relative impact compared to other acts of violence. But I agree with Colin, you know, in a way, given the way we react to terrorism, the terrorists have already had a significant impact, I don't want to say victory, but they've certainly caused us to adjust the way we live in a free society.
Right. Well, in fact, at the end of your article, both you and Colin Clark just call for continued vigilance. You say a vigilant society is a safer one. Well, Louis Clarivas, professor of global studies at UMass Boston, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Colin Clark, political scientist and researcher at the RAND Corporation, thank you so much as well.
Thanks for having me.
After a year and a half of institutional soul searching, Boston's Museum of Fine Arts has a new strategic plan. The 3-year blueprint is designed to make sure the museum remains relevant in the 21st century by broadening the museum's mission, reach, and audience. As WBUR's Andrea Shea reports, one major goal is diversifying the museum's staff.
MFA Director Matthew Teitelbaum shares a phrase he thinks says a lot about the new strategic plan's goals and the next chapter for the museum.
Outward facing. Be more inviting to our visitors, more engaging when they're here. I think it should be a place where everybody feels they belong.
But there can be barriers to belonging, high ticket prices for one, also age and cultural differences. According to the MFA, in 2015, 67% of visitors were female, 75% were 45 or older, and 79% identified as Caucasian. Teitelbaum says the strategic plan's more than 50 new initiatives are designed to change that. With input from about 70 staff members, they include everything from movies on the museum's lawn, a late-night series, and a free family membership program for newly naturalized U.S. citizens. Teitelbaum says the blueprint is visitor-focused.
How are they represented? How do they feel empowered by their visit? One way to do that is through diversification of staff. It's certainly a way to increase diversification of audience because it is a subset of a feeling. I belong here because when I come here, I feel comfortable.
Only about 20% of the MFA's 700-plus member staff self-identifies as non-white. 14% of that 20% are in professional ranks, including curators. Teitelbaum and the MFA are not alone with their drive to shift the museum's internal culture.
In order to stay relevant, institutions, cultural organizations that in a meaningful way lack for diversity are really going to be threatened themselves and really fail to provide for the needs of the society that we're building and that is emerging.
Roger Schoenfeld leads a research and consulting program at the nonprofit Ithaca SNR and has been tracking demographics in the art museum world with the Mellon Foundation. In 2015, they released a study that changed the national conversation about diversifying a field where most employees do not match the diversity of American society. Now the collaboration is collecting more data through ongoing case studies of 8 art museums that Schoenfeld says are achieving a relative degree of racial diversity in professional roles.
We recognize that some of these museums, even among the 8, would say that they have a lot further to go themselves.
The Museum of Fine Arts is an encyclopedic museum, and it positions itself as a museum that speaks about the cultures of the world.
Edmund Barry Gaither directs the Museum of the National Center of Afro-American Artists in Roxbury. He's also a consulting curator at the MFA, where he's organized exhibitions featuring African-American artists. Gaither says the museum's plan to hire people of different backgrounds and cultures will translate to the narratives on the gallery walls and ultimately to the visitors.
To do that convincingly, and frankly, to do it in the most honest way possible, it needs at the professional curatorial level to have people whose voice and visions are as rich and as complex as the stories that are being told.
Curators at the MFA have been working to broaden the scope of their narratives. One high-profile example is a work the museum acquired about a year and a half ago by famed Mexican artist Frida Kahlo. Director Teitelbaum says the painting's installation in this top-floor gallery tells a unique story of art and culture in Kahlo's country and time, and it's the first Kahlo in a New England museum's collection. That said, Teitelbaum also wants to make something clear.
I would not want this acquisition to be so purposely prescribed that people thought, oh, they only bought it because it was going to show diversity. We bought it because it was a great work of art by a very important artist.
The curator who found the Kahlo is Elliot Bostwick Davis. She heads the MFA's Art of the Americas department and has been focused on diversifying her staff along with the narratives.
The top job I have is to really get the best people in our field and help them stay in our field so that they don't leave to head out to for-profit, perhaps.
Davis says the museum field needs a more diverse candidate pipeline. The strategic plan includes paid teen internships and mentoring programs to develop the next generation of museum professionals that she hopes will bring fresh perspectives to the table. The museum's more than 1,000 volunteers will be part of the cultural shift, too, along with the Board of Trustees. At this time, there are 3 open curatorial department head positions that need to be filled. As the museum faces many new questions, Teitelbaum says some of them are eternal.
Why should people come to museums? What is the power and value of museums? And people do come to museums, and they're deeply valued in communities, but we must always keep that question alive. Why do people want to come? What do they want to celebrate? What do they want to experience?
With all this change in the wind, Teitelbaum adds it's also critical not to leave the MFA's core audience behind.
That report from WBUR's Andrea Shea. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For the next couple of weeks, we're going to be following the case of a Plainville woman who allegedly encouraged or even coerced her friend to commit suicide, mostly through text messages. Conrad Roy was 18 when he killed himself 3 years ago. The manslaughter case against his friend Michelle Carter hinges on whether words alone are the same thing as actually helping a person take his own life. Today, Carter's friends took the stand to testify. Here's Alexis Eblin reading a text Michelle Carter sent her on the night of Roy's suicide, July 12, 2014.
He called me and I heard like muffled sounds and some type of motor running, and it was like that for 20 minutes and he wouldn't answer. I think he killed himself.
Well, Boston Globe reporter Jan Ransom was at the Taunton Courthouse where this case is going on, and she joins us. Hi there, Jan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. I understand that right now you're actually in the parking lot in Fairhaven where Conrad Roy was found dead?
Yes. We're over here now. The prosecutors brought Judge Manzio over here to the scene where Conrad's vehicle was found. It's something that they do in most criminal cases. Usually if there were a jury involved, the jury would have been present, but in this case, it's just the judge.
I see. And so were you able to, I mean, I don't know where press was allowed to stand. Were you able to hear anything about the nature of the discussion that happened between counsel and the judges at the parking lot?
Yes, we got pretty close. It was pretty much a basic discussion. The prosecutor pretty much, pointed out that the Kmart was pretty much several feet away from where Conrad parked. He parked in sort of a secluded portion of the parking lot. There is a main part of the parking lot where it's heavily trafficked, and he was away from all of that. And also at the parking spot, there were some flowers that were set up as a memorial for him.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, today, to get back to what happened in the courtroom today, it was four women who testified about the defendant, Michelle Carter, and text messages they received from her about Conrad Roy and his death. What happened?
Yeah, so today was day two in the trial, and prosecutors today continue to paint the picture of Michelle Carter as this attention-seeking teenager who essentially used Conrad's death as a way to improve her social standing. Prosecutors called four women to the stand, as you mentioned, and they all each testified that Michelle texted them when Conrad was found. And she said on the phone, she said that she was on the phone with him essentially during the time of his death.
Wow. So we've got some tape here from key testimony from one of the witnesses, Samantha Boardman, who also went to school with Michelle Carter. So let's listen to a little bit about what she said today.
Sam, his death was my fault. Like, honestly, I could have stopped him. I was on the phone, and he got out of the car because it was working, and he got scared, and I told him to get back in, Sam, because I knew he would do it all. All over again the next day, and I couldn't have him live the way he was living anymore. I couldn't do it, and I wouldn't let him.
So that's Samantha Boardman, I think, testifying as to something that she says Michelle Carter told her. Was this before Conrad Roy actually did take his own life?
No, this was actually after.
After, okay.
Yes. It was kind of bizarre, this sort of strict series of text messages that were sent. Conrad had even killed himself, she was saying that she was concerned about him, his well-being, and that he was missing, and that he was going through a difficult time. And then once she actually knew and was on the phone with him, she was still pretending to not totally understand what had happened to him and where he was. And then on July 13, 2014, when the family was aware and it was pretty much, you know, police were involved, you know, she contacted all four women and said he committed suicide. And prosecutors used those text messages today to show that, you know, she was doing this basically just to get sympathy and to be the quote-unquote grieving girlfriend. Hmm.
I mean, this is all very chilling to hear, especially since, I mean, her words were documented in these text messages. But of course, I mean, yesterday in opening arguments, Michelle Carter's defense team is making the point that there's no legislation that criminalizes words that may encourage someone to take their own life, and that at the end of the day, sadly, tragically, Conrad Roy is responsible for the actions he took against himself. I mean, what did they say today, or what questions did they ask the witnesses today to bolster their argument in her defense?
Yeah, they didn't stray too far from the points that they were making yesterday. They continued to highlight that, you know, Conrad was researching ways to kill himself, and, you know, that's something that he had wanted for a long time. And there was a detective on the stand, and the defense, you know, wanted to know from him, you know, well, did you speak to the companies that run the website or the people who run the website that, you know, highlight suicide? And so they continue to focus on putting, I guess, the blame, if you will, on Conrad and away from Michelle.
Hmm. Well, that's the Boston Globe's Jan Ransom bringing us up to speed on testimony today in the manslaughter case against Michelle Carter. Jan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
All right, well, let's shift gears entirely and end the show today with some sports talk with Bill Littlefield, the host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, I am so delighted to see you across the table from me again today.
It's a great pleasure to be here, Magda.
Okay, you know, I thought we were going to start with some light sports news, but we're not. We're going to start with something a little more serious, because what's this about Red Sox broadcaster Jerry Remy saying that language interpreters shouldn't be allowed on the pitcher's mound during Major League Baseball games?
Yeah, apparently during a broadcast, he made that opinion public, and I'm pretty sure he wishes he hadn't. No good can come of this sort of thing, obviously.
Well, let's play the actual tape of what happened here, because apparently his comments came during yesterday's game between the Sox and the Yankees. It had to be that, right? After Yankees...
otherwise, nobody would have been paying attention.
Yeah. And this happened after Yankees pitcher Masahiro Tanaka from Japan had a translator and a pitching coach meet with him on the mound. And so we're going to hear what Jerry Remy says. He speaks first in this exchange with co-announcer Dave O'Brien.
With Tanaka, they take out a translator. I don't think that should be legal.
Seriously?
I really don't.
Well, I mean, Tanaka can reportedly speak English well enough to speak informally with his teammates. But, I mean, Remy was, I think he was making the point. What point was he making, actually?
Well, that's what it's a little bit hard to understand. It's obviously a personal opinion. Major League Baseball has made it very clear that they're perfectly happy having translators. In fact, teams are required to have translators for Spanish-speaking players. The question I had when I first heard about this story was, what possible advantage does somebody gain by having a translator come out with the pitching coach? There is no competitive advantage to be gained by that, so why would there be an objection? It's sort of the sports version of, if an immigrant wants to come to this country, then they, by golly, better learn English, because they shouldn't expect to be able to get by in their own language. And that's insane.
I mean, didn't Remy actually even refer to baseball language as a thing?
Yeah, and I think what he was talking about there was, you know, one is a fastball, two is a curveball. I mean, it's not hard. Or, you know, put your hands down like this. It means keep the ball low to this guy or he'll hit out of the park. That's almost irrelevant. But the idea of, you know, that there shouldn't be a translator because... Well, because why? There is no competitive advantage to be gained by it, so I don't really see why it's an issue.
As American as baseball, apple pie, and linguistic bigotry,
yeah,
I guess.
And baseball, of course, is so much less U.S. than it used to be. I've been sort of looking over the figures in preparation for coming over here today. And, you know, Hispanic players, Spanish-speaking players, yeah. Number somewhere between 27% and 30% in Major League Baseball. And in the minor leagues, I'm sure the percentage is much higher. And, of course, this is a trend that began when the people running Major League Baseball teams suddenly figured out that they could sign a whole lot of Latino players for what it cost them to sign one through the draft in the U.S. So it's economics. And so, you know, again, it's not a U.S. game anymore exclusively. It hasn't been for quite a long time. There are players from all over the world and especially from Spanish-speaking countries. And there's really no reason why they shouldn't be accommodated, those of them who do not grow up speaking English.
Well, it's interesting because apparently Remy's comments come just a couple of days after Mike Schmidt had to apologize for saying that a Spanish-speaking Phillies player could not be a team leader because of that same language barrier, I guess. And we've got some tape here of Schmidt critiquing Phillies Obel Herrera on Philadelphia's CBS radio.
First of all, it's a language barrier. And, you know, because of that, I think he can't be a guy that would, you know, sort of sit in a circle with four or five American players and talk about the game.
Okay, so this is slightly different than having a conversation on the pitcher's mound with a pitching coach. I mean, I'm just gonna play the devil's advocate here, Bill. Does he have a point? I mean, what role does the team leader play? And specifically here, that, you know, perhaps could it require a facility in English to effectively be that leader?
Well, the first point that occurs to me is that somebody who speaks Spanish is probably going to be speaking to 30% of the team perfectly comfortably.
Good point.
So that's point number one. So right. If he's got four or five players sitting around him, two of those players are very likely to be very comfortable with his Spanish. Maybe we should wonder why people in this country don't learn more than one language.
I feel like we need the Justin Trudeau of baseball now.
That's another issue entirely.
You know how the Canadian leader does all his press conferences in English and French? We need like the Justin Trudeau of baseball.
Yeah. The other thing is, to the point that you were making, there are all kinds of ways to be a leader. There are a great many athletes, not just baseball players, who have been superb leaders within the context of their teams who are not especially articulate. And I could name some of them at the risk of making a fool of myself or getting myself in hot water, so I won't. But people can probably, sports fans at least, can probably make their own lists.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of ways to lead. Beyond that, if a player who speaks Spanish primarily wants to be in a leadership role and he wants to communicate to players who don't speak Spanish on his team and say something specific, that's precisely why Major League Baseball now requires teams to have translators.
Those translators, exactly.
I don't really see the issue there either.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a second about another controversial subject in sports. And this is the fact that the Massachusetts legislature is considering a bill that would ban the use of Native American mascots in public schools. And this comes after the town of Tewksbury refused to change the name of the town high school mascot. And actually, in Tewksbury, there was overwhelming support to keep the name.
Mm-hmm. As there has been in lots of towns where this sort of controversy has come up, people are very passionately wedded to tradition in this particular sort of matter. And again, everybody's entitled to their opinion, I suppose. My feeling is, why not pick a more fun mascot and not run the risk of offending anybody? Because it's sometimes hard to tell who's going to be offended by what. I'm a fan, for example, of the Santa Cruz Fighting Banana Slugs.
Yeah.
who offend nobody because banana slugs are incapable of expressing.
There's probably a banana slugs rights organization.
There will be after this broadcast.
But on a more serious note, I mean, like, look, according to the New England Anti-Mascot Coalition, there are 89 different schools with Native American mascots, not to mention the fact that the flag of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the seal of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, also has a Native person on there, but we've actually had that discussion before on this show. Hey, Bill, we've got just under a minute to go, and I would love if you could give me a preview of what we're going to hear on Only a Game this weekend.
Well, we're going to celebrate the 100th anniversary of a birth of a great athlete, and I don't know if we have the time to hear any of the tape that goes along with that, but we are going to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of Man of War, one of the great four-legged athlete. In 1920, there were two athletes of the year in the United States. One was Man of War, and the other was Babe Ruth. And we haven't been able yet to determine how Babe Ruth felt about sharing that title with Man of War. But everybody we've talked to so far has said that they feel that he should have been flattered.
Bill Littlefield, thanks so much.
Thanks, Magna.
That's it for today. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.